You're listening to KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and this is community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they are now available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien, and and our special guest tonight is Nikki Rapana. And Nikki is a 52-year-old first-generation Alaskan grandmother, co-founder of the online research project known as Anti-Communitarian League, and author of 2020 Designer Builder of Gertees, G-E-R-T-E-E-S. And they're a cross between a teepee and a yurt. And the co-owner of a small web writer business in rural Alaska called Alaskan Web Writers. And Katie and Nikki, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. And I gave a little brief background from your bio, but I think it'd be kind of good to have you go ahead and cover a little bit more of your background. But first, let me say the opinions and the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay, Nikki?
Well, that's a good disclaimer. I'm not quite sure how to introduce myself to people that have never listened to me or read anything that I've written. And I'm sorry my bio page is so long. I should have a nice little concise one, you know. But mainly, I'm an Army brat. I was raised by a professional career military man who brought me up with certain values that just about anybody who's ever grown up in the military, they know them, you know. You know, God, country, and the 82nd Airborne, you know. So as I grew older, we had a lot of dissension in our family, political views. And when I went to college, my dad actually thought I had turned into a socialist. And there was a point in the 80s, when I was studying at University of Massachusetts Amherst, was one of the colleges I went to. I did video documentary investigative journalism classes, and started out as a theater major and then did very well in English and got talked into joining the English department, and the next thing you knew, I was studying to be a reporter, which I wasn't very good at, but I was really good at the research. So I made that my focus, and I studied economic policy in Central America under the Reagan administration, what happened between Carter and Reagan mainly. And I kind of lost a lot of faith in America. You know, my dad and I suddenly weren't on the same side. And I left college and went back to Alaska and got married and had children and just became a regular person.
Why did you lose faith in America?
Well, because of the policies under the Reagan administration, I wasn't prepared for the type of activities that we were involved in internationally. I didn't understand American foreign policy then, and even what I do understand about it now, it makes me sad. The money that I was following, particularly in Nicaragua and El Salvador, and what was happening in you know, in the neighboring countries where we were, you know, building military bases and then trying to find the money that was funding the Contras, and then years later, actually it wasn't that long later, but with what, it's the Iran, you know, drugs for arms scandal. I was a novice at what I was reading, and I found most of it to be very upsetting. And then trying to defend America under those circumstances, I found it impossible. So it was just a rude awakening for me, and I didn't want anything to do with it. I didn't want to know any more than what I knew. I guess in some ways you can say I'm like the person that sticks their head back in the sand, you know. the doors opened a little bit, and it was a really ugly place. So I shut it down, but then I ended up moving outside, and I spent a year in Vegas, I had a waiter's training company, and I had published, the only book I ever published up to that point was Making Money, a Waiter's Tips, and I was selling the program to the casinos and the culinary union, and then I went to Wisconsin and was going to do it under the Welfare to Work program. And then I had stopped in Seattle on my way back up the Alcan. I was coming back to Alaska. My daughter was in sixth grade, and a good friend of mine had fallen pretty ill, and her house was a mess, and she was alone. So I asked my daughter how she felt about it, and she agreed to stay for a few months and help her clean the house and just get well. And that's where I ended up in the pilot test for all of the new vision for Seattle. And that's how I got involved in all this stuff, was because while I was living at that house, a lot of actions were being taken against the landlord who owned the place. And I opened my big mouth one day and told him that, you know, because he thought that the city of Seattle was stealing his land. And I said, no, they can't steal your land. This is America, you know. The whole system is based on property rights, you know. You can't lose your property. And I started helping him, trying to find out what exactly was going on in the programs. And that was March of 99. So it's been almost 10 years since I learned that America wasn't the same place that I thought it was, even after I left college, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of hard to explain that to people. And they want to know why I do it. You know, I don't really make any money doing it. And I live in really nice tents now so that I can, you know, write as much as I can. I haven't done a lot of writing lately. I've mostly been working on my house. But, you know, more and more people are starting to learn about the programs, trying to find out in their own neighborhood what's happening to their communities. And so the work is serving a purpose now. But I got to say that for like the first 4 or 5 years, everybody thought I was wasting my time. So, you know, it's been a long road. And I don't know if I explained it very well or not, you know. Because I still have, you know, there's certain things that we were talking earlier about beliefs, you know, that I still believe in America. I still believe that our law was established to protect us from tyranny, and that those are the laws that I defend, and those are the ones that I hang on to. And if they weren't created for that, then I'm really stupid, you know, because who can be sure, you know? So, what ultimately was the goal here.
Okay, and so when you got started in this, then you really had to look in legal issues, did you not?
Yes, it all started with the hearing and review boards.
Okay, and what are those?
Over land use violations.
What's a hearing and review board?
Well, it's an examiner type person that's set up by within departments in the city of Seattle. It was the Department of Design, Construction, and Land Use, which I just went to their website the other day, and now it's not called that anymore. They changed the name of almost every agency I dealt with in Seattle. But
do you think that was done for a reason?
Yeah, it makes it harder to follow the trail.
Oh dear. Okay.
So yeah, like in Seattle, one of the main groups that had recommended the changes in the law for our neighborhood was a group called Tomorrow's Roosevelt Committee. And by the time I got to looking into this whole thing, they had already disbanded. And I was continually asking people how to find them, and everyone told me they didn't know. And when I finally found Tomorrow's Roosevelt Committee, half the people that I had talked to had been on that committee.
So did they not know it or what?
No, they knew it.
Oh.
They know. The questions that I was asking were so simple and so ridiculous that it's amazing that so much happened as a result of that, because I just expected, first of all, that anybody that worked for the city of Seattle and had that good of a job, you know, they were smarter than me. They were better educated. They knew more. They were, you know, there was somehow that they were better qualified, you know. So I trusted that in the beginning, but they didn't know what they were talking about. They couldn't give me a definition to anything. And very simple terms that they were using to explain, like some of the activities that they were doing, I would, you know, ask why they seemed ridiculous, okay. And their attitude was that we should be helping them to get my landlord to lose his property. and they couldn't understand why I was helping him defend his property. And they had called him a slumlord, and you know, actually, he's not the best guy on the planet, okay? And I said that it has nothing to do with his character. You know, property rights are property rights. Either we all have them or we all don't. I thought everybody understood that, you know? And I also had grown up in a country that tolerated different types of people. You know, every neighborhood I've ever lived in had a weirdo that everybody thought. Sometimes I was the weirdo, you know? But it doesn't mean you tried to get them to move out of the neighborhood. We started picketing them or put them in a database and identified them and put a sign on their house and said, bad person lives here. So I was kind of astonished at the types of remarks that were made. People were called trash and pigs in the meetings. We have to clean up the neighborhood means we got to get rid of the pigs. And then they had a program called Weed and Seed. You familiar with that one?
It's called what?
Weed and Seed.
Okay. No, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. Well, that the police there are, guarantee you. It's a HUD program, and they also expanded it under community-oriented policing services. In 94 and 95, quite a bit of legislation was passed at the U.S. congressional level, the Domestic Violence Act, the Revised Violent Crime Act, and inside that legislation was a lot of the spying activities, local spying, where they started what they called interdepartmental cross-training programs, where they trained all city and county employees to report life-threatening things that they witnessed inside people's homes while they were there on normal business. And we were a pilot test for that database. And HUD Weed and Seed program actually started before community policing, but they were already working with the police. And what that program did was identify the bad weeds in the neighborhood, pull them, and replant good seeds. So bad weeds were defined as transients, people that, this is a university neighborhood, people that don't live there or don't own property there, that, you know, just stay there for a while, were actually called transients with a significant negative impact on the neighborhood. And I found that very offensive, so I wanted to know more. Why did you write that about me in your plan? That was in the Matrix for the Roosevelt Neighborhood Plan. And in 99, the city of Seattle passed 38 revised neighborhood plans. Actually, I don't even know if they had them prior to that. But now they're doing their 10-year assessment of the great success of these neighborhood plans. And it's interesting that there's nothing, none of our complaints, none of the lawsuits are included in any of these assessments. We just did not exist. And there was a lot of people who started to understand what was happening under these new plans. So, I wasn't alone at the time, and quite a few of those people ended up being some unsavory type characters. But, you know, when you go into meetings and you're sitting in there and you're the only person in the room who is paying attention to the language that they use, a lot of people, it's not that they don't pay attention to the language, they don't understand what they're saying. It doesn't sound right, but they're not sure why. So a lot of my effort and my work has been to translate it. I write dictionaries and everything, you know, call them Orwellian doublespeak dictionaries so that you can understand when they say that it's about quality of life. It's not the same thing that you might think quality of life means. And to a lot of Americans, quality of life means I get to leave me alone. You know,
what do you think they did with, where did they expect the people to go that didn't fit their criteria?
Into government-subsidized housing. The government's new job is to provide safe and affordable housing. So any low-income person who owns property and rents it at a lower income level because it's not the best house and not the best neighborhood is called a slumlord, someone who's taken advantage of these poor victim tenants. And, what they want to do is regulate rental property as a business and tax you on it.
Are these done by third-party entities? Those that are overseeing these rental properties.
You mean the...
Like they are public-private partnerships. No?
I think that's the goal.
Okay.
That's what they had in the plan. Anybody who wants to be in a private-public partnership with them gets the contracts.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. Right.
Yeah, and because they're rebuilding. It's all about rebuilding America. It's a very prominent role in the Bush administration. It plays a prominent role under Clinton. All the way back as far as I went, it actually goes back to the Marshall Plan in Europe. In fact, right now there's a global Marshall Plan.
Really?
Because of the economic crisis, they've realized that they just have to rebuild the whole world. And part of the rebuilding process and the structure under communitarian supremacy of law is your national law has to be modified to accommodate the new law. And they've done it in various ways, but in my neighborhood, they did it through neighborhood plans. In Anchorage, it's called Anchorage 2020 Vision for the Future, you know. Scenic byways is another way they do it in the rural areas, you know. Wilderness designation, buffer zones around parks, you know.
Well, how would all that tie into
land use?
Okay.
It's all about the land.
Okay.
And the people living on the land are merely resources, assets, or problems, they call them. They have problem-oriented policing, and then they have asset-based community development. You're pretty much identified as either a problem or an asset. And that's where you become either a weed or a seed, you know? they're serious.
So where are they training these people that come in and do these programs?
I found some of the actual programs in England, but Harvard, Yale, I've talked to professors at most of the major law schools that write about communitarianism and tried to get them to debate me on the law, but I think right now it's pretty much in every college in the country and globally. In some places around the world, they actually call them communitarian programs, but not in America.
What do they call them here?
Quality of life seminars. That's what Vassar College called it. They call it international law. It can just be under that. The Jean Monnet School of Law at New York University is one of I follow them pretty closely because Jean Monnet, of course, is the architect of the European Union. So any of the schools that are associated with him or do seminars for the Jean Monnet, you know, international programs, it's all about communitarian law.
Okay, now tell us this communitarian law has to tie into Agenda 21, does it not?
It is the law in Agenda 21.
Okay, and then you might explain a little bit of that if you would like.
Okay, well, the philosophy behind communitarianism is that the community has rights the same as an individual. In fact, actually, the community has really more rights than the rights of the individual. So what a communitarian law does is balance the rights of the individual against the rights of the faceless community. So based on that, the Local Agenda 21 Blueprint for the Global Government System is all about how you accommodate yourself and build the bureaucratic structure for the global government. And communitarian law is the new law that it's inserted all. I mean, any law that balances, when they use that term balance, it's a key word, they're balancing the rights of the individuals against the community. Well, under their legal system, private property can no longer be tolerated. And they've said this, they say this in a lot of places. It's not like you can't even find that. Obviously the Marxists agree with it totally, you know. But it's redistribution of wealth and redistribution of assets. And before they can redistribute everything, first they have to fill their database and find out what you have. So they come into your town and they write a program that will gather data, and they do it in a whole bunch of different ways. And Agenda 21 has many suggestions, emergency plans, health and safety checks in the community, or asset-based community development, which is ABCD development. And that's where they go and interview you and ask you what you know how to do and how you can contribute, because the communitarian system requires you to be a community volunteer, a citizen corps. And the people that are, they've created all these programs. There is a citizens corps, everything. And they do nice things, okay? It's not like they're bad in and of, you know, I mean, it's almost like anything else. When you're on the lower level of something, you're actually doing the good work. What it's leading towards, you probably won't know until it's too late for you to know anything. So most people that I was dealing with in Seattle, they thought they were doing a good thing. They were building a beautiful new city, they said. Why didn't I want that? So did I answer your question very well?
But as far as it ties into a lot of different aspects of running the world on a global scale. And the communitarianism is communes, is it not?
Well, it's a capitalist commune.
Okay.
That practices free trade. It's a balance between the left and the right. It's the perfect middle between all opposites, all opposite religions, all opposite beliefs, all opposing law is being balanced. So that they can appeal to the neocon, you know, warmongers on the right and appeal to the most hardcore Leninists on the left, you know. It's called the third way or the third wave.
Why does that sound so warm and fuzzy in a way, and yet at the same time, you know, if you're not paying attention, it can kind of be something a whole lot more different than what you think it is?
Because they're professional propagandists. Some of the earliest stuff comes from the Fabian Society, and they were a society in London that were created in the 1890s sometime to promote the message via propaganda and lies. You know, and I was just reading last night on that, you know, Gallatin, the Secretary of the Treasury under Thomas Jefferson, you know, was a professional propagandist. It's been used so successfully in places where they know. It's like, how did they convince the German people that everything was so wonderful, you know? And in Russia, they still try to tell them how great it was, you know? Is through propaganda and lies. And eventually you believe the lie. It's like all these years that I thought property rights were enshrined in gold somehow, you know? And it was kind of my dad's motto, because we didn't really have a lot when I was growing up. And he always said, you know, when we'd say, oh, those people have a really nice house or they have a really nice car, you know, and he'd say, yeah, well, we might not have much, but I make damn sure all them people can keep what they have, you know? That was his job. Was to protect everybody's right to keep their stuff.
And what was his job? I mean,
he was a drill instructor, and he was also a recruiter.
Oh, okay.
He went through. He retired sergeant major.
Okay, all right.
He was career.
Okay.
And that's how he justified everything that we didn't have, was because everybody else got to.
Okay, so he was defending the country and...
Yes,
okay.
And he meant it.
Mm-hmm.
And they all meant it, all the military men and even the, you know, the cops in Seattle. And when I started asking the police if they were a community cop or a cop, the ones that were not community cops told me, I'm a real cop. You have a real crime, call me, you know? Because community cops are mental health officers, they're community services officers. They, you know, help people in the community. They help abate your house. They help get you treatment. They do interventions. They ask their neighbors about you to see if you're mean to your kids, because they might need to save your children from you. It's very invasive stuff that they practice. And you know, I wasn't that familiar with the Stasi or anything, what was going on in Germany all those years. But I'm learning now, you know, that... it's a lot cheaper if you can get people to spy on each other and report on each other. than to do it yourself, you know?
Mm-hmm. But they could do that, you know, electronically without even having that if they really wanted to.
I think that it's a lot more, they're more interested in anecdotal data right now. Gossip was a big part of what was in our database because they didn't have that much on people. Now, I don't know, it's been 10 years. They were getting all the unemployment records, all the records from, you know, the schools, the court system. The juvenile records were turned over to them in 2000. So, you know, what they're doing is profiling everyone to see if they want you to be a participant in this new beautiful vision that they're building. And then there's all that stuff about population stuff that they talk about, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that falls right into line with one of the President Bush's executive orders in regard to having citizens spy on other citizens. And if not, there would be consequences.
Consequences?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know which executive order you're talking about? Or?
I can look that up right quick if you like, but that's one of the ones that he passed in 2005. Along with the executive order that he could round up people to be work crews, and that he came up with both of these within a very short time period.
And if you look behind those executive orders, you'll find a man called Dr. Amitai Etzioni.
Oh, that's Doctor the first I've ever heard of. I saw that on your website, but I wasn't quite sure. I mean, that's the first I'd run across his name.
He's the communitarian guru. He's been an advisor in the White House since 79.
Interesting.
He's, like, to me, he's the most, in fact, somebody in the British UK Libertarian Forum just wrote a little piece called "The Most Influential Man You've Never Heard Of." Which I thought was great because, I'd never heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
So I've written quite a bit about him, and he knows who I am. I've had a bit of correspondence with him back in the beginning. He ignores me completely now, but I wanted to debate him for a really long time. A public debate, you know. I was like so naive. I still had all these ideas that about America that... you know, I kind of lived in my own little belief bubble, I guess you might call it, you know. I'm a positive thinker normally. It's funny that I ended up with a group called the Anti-Communitarian League, you know, because people say, well, why don't you, that's such a negative name, Nikki, you know, you need a more positive name. And I'm thinking about that actually right now. I was thinking about United Commoners Association or something, because a lot of what I study is elite academic snobbery.
And why is that?
Because that's who they are. That's all of this stuff came out of upper academia in the 80s. And, you know, by the time it reaches you, you don't understand it, but that makes you some stupid belligerent commoner if you're asking. If you're still talking about property rights, get on the bandwagon, baby. You know, nobody believes in property rights anymore. That's already been balanced. You know, I'm talking about privacy rights in Seattle, and Amitai Etzioni's book, The Limits of Privacy, is sitting on the mayor's desk. All of your public officials in this country know who Amitai Etzioni is, and right now his book is being used to train in the Pentagon, From Empire to Community, A New Approach to International Relations. He says the world needs a new global architecture, because the nation states just simply cannot deal with it. So Local Agenda 21 is the backdoor blueprint that all the restructuring, the regional restructuring that began at the lowest community level has been going on for quite some time now. And now the global architecture and America's role in the New World Order is as the military might, and then we've already been the taxpaying money behind it, you know? It's on our sweat and blood. We're paying for our own slavery now.
I remember hearing him talk about, you know, getting us to pay for it, but I couldn't even fathom how they could just put it on the backs of a specific group, but they've done it.
Well, they were introducing community taxes in Wyoming when I was there in 2004.
Well, isn't that kind of what Barack Obama's talking about a little bit?
Well, he's talking about it a lot, actually. Yeah, his Global Poverty Act is a piece of work. I just finally went and looked at that. But then, you know, McCain and Palin, they're cut from the same cloth. They introduce the same programs. They all support sustainable development. They all support rebuilding America. They all support rebuilding the world. You know, and all the issues that they've created, to me, are just smoke screens for, you know, what the ultimate plan here is. And we're getting closer all the time. So, you know, my feeling that I thought America would find out about this and rush right down to City Hall and fire everybody, you know?
No, we're all just being boiled frogs.
Yeah.
And we're not even, you know, I mean, I'm amazed at how many people have no clue of what is being implemented right before our eyes because they put nice, warm, fuzzy words on them. And, of course, everybody wants to save the world and the environment. But has anybody read some of their prior documents at the turn of the century that tell us that, you know, they were going to utilize the term environment to bring in their new world order?
No, and they've done a really good job. The British are the experts on the American conspiracy mind. They, in fact, they're writing the encyclopedia on American conspiratorial thought. And the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. Bill of Rights are topics.
And who's doing this?
I think it's the University at Winchester, but I'd have to check my site. I have it on my conspiracy theory page. I just after reading their upper academic papers for so long, one of the hardest things to do is when I started writing about what they were saying, I used way too much of their language, so nobody could understand me either.
Well,
I don't talk like that, you know. So I mean, I stumble over these words. Like, in fact, I called it communitarianism, and my daughter went nuts. She's like, it's communitarianism. And I go, yeah, I said that, right? Communitarianism. So I don't pronounce words very well. I'm a reader, not a speaker. So it was a challenge. And then when people ask me, please explain it to us in 30 words or less, I just sit there silent, you know. I don't know how to do that. So the challenge was interpreting it. Taking the words, and so, you know, I have like this ridiculous glossary that I actually had a lot of fun writing it. I wrote it in a tent, my first tent winter camping in Hansville, Washington, over on John's farm, where I called, you know, scientist means God, you know, things like that, because the way that they present these highly academic solutions to the environment and things, you know, like crime and disorder. And what, you know, one of the main programs they had going in Seattle was to prevent full-blown fear. So what's full-blown fear? Well, it's the fear that no one's in charge and nobody cares. So they've been writing about this potential for full-blown fear and using it as a justification for all kinds of invasive new police actions in communities. And it's like Bush's doctrine, okay, that Palin supposedly didn't understand, about preemptive strikes. We're going to find the terrorists before they even attack. And so they're doing the same thing with the people. You know, they have to know which people are going to go along with the plan and which ones aren't, you know, and that's pretty obvious.
And that's why they're profiling them?
Yes.
Okay.
And they also need to know what skills and abilities you have that you can contribute to the community. Because they're major organizers.
Because if you don't contribute, you're a useless eater then.
You're a problem.
Right.
You're a weed.
You're a weed. You got to be pulled. And where they go, I couldn't tell you, okay? A lot of speculation out there. A lot of talk about camps. A lot of talk about prison systems. A lot of talk about railways being, you know, that go nowhere and things. Just, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You can find all kinds of scary stuff out there. And what I know is that the new laws are to modify behavior. You have to learn to be a global citizen. You don't just naturally become one. They know this, even though they call it natural evolution sociology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is our we're advancing to the point of enlightenment where there are no individuals left. It's totally a global consciousness, because they also bill it as a spiritual program, because behind the law is the religion, okay? But I don't like to go into that part at all, because, you know, it's just nuts. But the new religion is right hand in hand with the new law. And then if you don't believe and you don't participate, then you have to be retrained, you know? Now, are they going to retrain us like in 1984? Are they going to stick rats in cages in front of our eyes or whatever, you know? I haven't seen anything like that, okay? What I've seen is ostracizing. I've seen them, you know, they shut me down in Seattle by calling me a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great marginalizing word.
Yeah. So I'm like, what conspiracy are you talking about? They asked me if I believed in black helicopters. I go, I don't know what you're talking about. I had to go look at everything that they called me. I had to go look up online. And my conspiracy theory page at the ACL is one of my most frequented pages, and it ended up being really long, too, because the British have written a lot about the Americans and our obsession with the UN, you know, and our obsession with the New World Order, and our obsession with believing that there's a group out there that want to take over the world.
So we're actually becoming a mental disease.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially if we talk about the Constitution, then we're really nuts, okay? So I didn't realize that. My dad talked about the Constitution like it was, you know, it was right next to the Ten Commandments, okay? On that level in my house. So to hear these people say it derogatorily was pretty shocking. Yeah, and so I found myself in this very strange position that if I wanted to know about the law and study the legislation, I was a freak. And I thought that was ridiculous, and I told them that, you know. How can you pass a law with words in it that you don't even know what they mean?
And they're not defined.
Yeah. And they're like, what does it matter to you?
Well, you're not allowed to ask questions. That's the number one thing. Just forget
no.
it.
So, and, you know, and I got that, I don't know, it's like I had to back up everything I ever said when I was a kid, and I spent my adult life expecting that from anybody that I was dealing with. I'm a very upfront person. You don't ever have to wonder what I'm thinking, you know, if you're around me. So I didn't have a problem, you know, going to these meetings and, you know, trying to understand, taking lots of notes, which I found out later was very intimidating. Even if you don't write anything down, whatever meeting you go to, take a big notepad and just sit there with it. They'll freak out. Because they edit you out of the meeting. They have what they're called speak outs. I'm sure you've been to these by now.
But I have not heard that term.
Oh, you haven't? Well, they use that a lot in Washington. Well, there's a facilitator, and they invite the community to come and to discuss this and that plan that they have. Some places they'll have all these wonderful maps of your property with other things on it other than your house or your farm. Sometimes it's a road or something else. People get a little upset when they see those maps, but for the most part, the meetings go exactly how the facilitators plan them, and they have a big, huge sheet with a marker. Sometimes it's an erasable board, and they get everybody to say whatever they want about the topic, and they write them on that board. And then when they produce the minutes of that meeting, anything that they don't agree with is never in the minutes.
Interesting. So they edit and censor out
what
they
totally.
Don't want.
Mm-hmm. Any complaints? If you look at the City of Seattle website today and see Sally Herman, I think is the new, I don't know her, but she's a new one. She's in charge of the whole assessment of the neighborhood plans 10 years later. You won't find one thing about Nikki Rapana or the Dawson versus the Seattle City of Seattle lawsuit. You won't find anything about what we did. 4 years of fighting that plan, and we're not anywhere on that site.
So they erase history and rewrite history.
Well, that goes along with that it doesn't matter if you vote, it matters if you count the votes.
Yeah.
Or who counts the votes.
Who counts the votes? Who writes the minutes? So
yep.
You need to write your own minutes at these meetings. Of course, you can't hardly get anybody to go. I couldn't get anybody to go. When I finally brought, like, five of the Dawson clients, I took them to one of the last meetings I went to where the Johnson Partnership was presenting their model, their architectural firm that were hired to revise or rebuild my neighborhood, and they didn't even own the property. And the people that I brought with me, you know, they had been listening to me, and they all thought I was losing my mind. I was like, well, you need to come into the meetings with me, okay, because I am not making this up. They leave, and the first, Jerry Dawson looks right at me and goes, I feel like I just stepped out of the Twilight Zone. I was crazy in there. Because they got their own show going, and if you do show up and you don't agree, then, you know, you're not invited back. And then they change the name of the group and start meeting somewhere else. So you got to look.
Well, they've got a plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, and so that's a pretty typical thing, the way they run meetings, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it's a format. They teach it in their colleges.
And it comes, and you might get into explaining that a little bit, so people can recognize it in case they are the one or two that do decide to show up.
Well, the problem is that, you know, we didn't grow up in a Soviet state, so we're totally not educated to what the community council, the role that the citizen council or the community council plays in controlling lives.
And a council is a Soviet.
Yes. That's actually what it means.
Right.
So the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was the council union. So, yeah, and they just keep making more councils. They're called advisory councils, citizens advisory councils. There's thousands of them in this country now. And they invite, you know, interested stakeholders, they call them. And they come in, and usually it's the local banker and the local realtor and the local architect that all just moved to the neighborhood so they could call themselves local. They usually come from somewhere else, and then sometimes they're attached to the Shriners, or they come in under some other church organization, Christians, everything. You know, they're in every organization.
Anything to give them credibility, in other words.
Yes.
Okay.
And then they have the longest curriculum vitae, or whatever you call that.
The what?
Their resumes.
Oh, okay.
Are some of the longest resumes. I mean, you know, you can read them for days. They brag. Check out Amitai Etzioni's resume sometime.
Okay. He's
It'll
a new
your
one.
Mind.
I've been trying to look up some of these people that are trying to put this organization around the world together, but he's, yeah, I mean, and I've found that it's those in the shadows that kind of get a lot of it done.
Yeah. Well, he was active in the New World Order Project since the 60s.
Wow. Is he like a comrade to Brzezinski or something?
Actually, he's called the guru, the
okay.
everything expert.
Okay.
He immigrated to the United States from the newly formed state of Israel.
Oh,
of which
okay.
he was a military participant, and he went to University of California, Berkeley, got his master's in sociology there, and then went to Columbia University, and within 10 years he was the head of the department.
Okay, now, I mean, Israel was kind of set up on a communal basis initially.
He was raised in the kibbutz, yes.
Okay.
Communist.
Okay.
Actually, the highest ranking official in Israel, for I don't know if it's still that way, was a card carrying communist Jew.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the preference that's given in housing, and I didn't know anything. That was a big area of contention between myself and my dad. It was bad because he was a huge fan of the Mossad. I grew up thinking Israel was just, you know. You know, the little scrapper nation that stood up to all them terrible Arabs, you know. and I'm sure for a lot of people that lived there, that was probably what was going on, you know. But no, there was bigger things going on there, too. When the British were de-invited, Amitai Etzioni, who was born Werner Falk, his family immigrated in the early 30s to Israel, but it, you know, if you try to talk to him about this, or if people ask him about this.
His name is Werner Falk?
Yeah.
Okay, but now, I did hear that name before.
Yeah, but he publishes under Amittai Etzioni, which actually means Tree of Life from Zion.
In fact, I thought I heard somebody give his name today and tie him in with the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, he's a member, okay. Or he has been before.
Or more like a leader in it.
Well, I think, he was military.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of the de-inviting of the British in 47, and then he fought against the seven Arab states in 48. And then he went straight from military. He was a terrorist, actually. He's published stuff about all of this, okay? In fact, I learned everything about Amittai Etzioni from Amittai Etzioni himself. And then he went to study under Martin Buber, who had just started a new school. And he was a Hasidic who was studying Kabbalah and Talmud, and came up with the I versus you theory. And a lot of the communitarian philosophy comes out of Buber.
How do you spell that?
Communitarianism, yeah.
How do you spell that, his last name?
Buber, B-U-B-E-R, Martin.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, I have an anthropology book that was sent to me by one of my supporters, and it was amazing. I read, it's this big, huge, fat book that, I don't know, where it is now, there's piles everywhere in here, but it was all about Buber's theory. They were going around, in the 50s, they had decided that because the airplane had, they said about it the same way they talk about the internet today, that airplanes had made it so that we were a global place. Nations were no longer necessary because of the airplane. And then they start writing about communal bonds. They studied all the tribal people, how they live, and made it seem like they were studying it for, you know, scientific reasons, that they had no other purpose. But now I see that what they were doing was cataloging the people. You know, they believe in retraining them. They like to move them. They like refugee camps. That's their favorite, you know. And when they started calling Americans from Katrina refugees, I was pretty upset, because under their refugee programs, whoa, you know, they do everything they want. They totally test everyone, and then they help you find a job. They find you housing. They give you clothes. They provide everything. The global government plans on providing everything you need. In order to understand it better, I went and read the Russian Communist Party platform in 2002. And what basic human rights include is housing and a job. And it's the government's job to provide them. So a lot of the stuff that I was seeing in Seattle was about preparation for that. Because in America, they're having a harder time. They can't just outright come and you know, round everybody up, and then what do you do with them, you know? I think they want to know who we are before they round us up.
Oh, they definitely do. I mean, that's why I think it's been taking a little bit longer time. And I think Katrina was a trial run.
Yeah.
Well, the executive order to organize civilians into work brigades is executive order 11,000.
11,000?
Yeah.
11,000. See, that's what
we're doing. And the one that required citizens to spy on neighbors was H.R. 1528. And it was a bill that went in. And then Bush actually did the executive order. Makes you wonder, why would we need this?
Well,
they also did MEPA.
What's that?
The Medical Emergency Health Prevention Act. They sent it to the states from the Center for Disease Control, wrote the blueprint. And they tried to push it through state legislatures, and actually the medical professional community in the United States pretty much whomped them on that one. Some states passed it, some, you know, they modified it in certain ways, but I'm sure Colorado had it either. They passed it or they introduced it there.
I'm not familiar with, I mean, I may have run across it, but I'm not, it doesn't.
Yeah, and inside that was, you know, confiscation of goods, confiscation of you, everything. It's like, I think that the legitimacy that they're seeking is the same thing that Hitler was doing with the Enabling Act, you know? Because it was pretty amazing when I studied Nazi Germany to realize that everything that they did was legal. They passed the laws and then they did it. So they're following that format here where, you know, I see, this is my thing, is I want to give people tools to fight back if you get arrested for a new law, to defend yourself and understanding the law that you're being charged under and not trying to defend yourself under a system that they think no longer exists. Because that's the big difference between us and them. Americans, you ask them if the police can just come in their house for any time they want. Every American I asked, and I asked hundreds of them, said no. They got to have a warrant. Now, they don't know what kind of warrant. They don't know anything else. But they'll tell you that. So there are people still think that that law is, the Fourth Amendment is, you know, on the books, right? And then, you know, so in Seattle, the chief of police called the Fourth Amendment an identified barrier to the program.
Isn't it amazing what they're doing with language?
Yes. And then they use different neighborhoods as, you know, as they call them, you know, tests, pilot tests for strategies, new strategies. And then they get together and share the strategies that work. And they start with people that nobody wants to defend. Like if you go into a gang-controlled neighborhood and you start talking to mothers and you say, we need to shut down these gangs and here's how we're going to do it. We're going to eliminate their all their rights and then then we can all be free and happy here. Well, I doubt that there was too many mothers standing up in those inner urban cities that are dealing with those kinds of issues that said, what about the rights of these kids, you know, and these gangs? So they do the same thing with criminals. Pedophiles are a perfect example, you know. Who's going to defend their right to live in your community anonymously? Nobody.
And that's why they always go after the marginal population or the marginal characteristics.
First.
Yeah.
And I think what U.S. citizens don't understand is that if they'll do it to them, they'll do it to us. They never get the connection that if it applies to that group over there, oh, it will apply to me.
When I told people about the raid for bugs and rats in Seattle, everyone that I talked to said, Nikki, there was something else going on there. Those people were doing drugs or something, okay? They could not accept that these people were innocent. So innocent until proven guilty isn't even in the national consciousness anymore. And there was no charges against those people. They were tenants. Public health warrants are traditionally served against the property owner.
So I don't see how, I mean, because when you're talking about people being able to defend themselves, the way they're writing these executive orders, it appears you don't have a defense.
No, because they basically rule over everything as an executive order.
Isn't that correct, Nikki?
Well, I think that I just had a whole weird situation a couple years ago where I agreed to be a third-party custodian for a friend of mine who'd been charged with domestic violence. And I've known this man 30 years, and I've never seen him do anything of the sort. And his the woman that charged him with domestic violence ended up being working with the court. She was really good friends with the city attorney who charged me. And it was a setup from the beginning. I mean, I found out later that she was working with a new police team. We were like stalked and stuff, and I eventually got arrested after 6 weeks because I violated what's called 24-hour sight and sound. I was supposed to be with them all the time, and it wasn't even checked in my paperwork, and I couldn't get the state of Alaska to give me a definition for 24-hour sight and sound. And I just couldn't even get him to give me a definition for third-party custodian. And I defended myself, and they didn't follow any of the court rules that they said in there. When I looked it up, you know, I was going to try and do it myself. And I was completely unfamiliar with criminal court, but I had been in civil litigation for years, so I thought I could, you know, read enough and figure it out. Well, I got bullied so bad. It took a year and a half. They finally convinced me to get a lawyer, and they gave me a public defender, who who had to quit because the woman who had accused my friend of being a wife beater had so many counts of charges and criminal charges against her that she had used up every free public defender in Anchorage. So I ended up with this hotshot murder attorney named Lance Wells, who's a very nice guy, but he thought it was the stupidest case he'd ever been on, and thought all the way through it that they were going to throw it out because it was really, you know, why were they charging me? He didn't understand it, and I told them I had looked it up and that they needed to start establishing case law, because a big part of the legal system is not the actual law. It's the case law that's established through the court system about that law.
Yeah.
So what I've done, basically, unknowingly and unwittingly, but I did it, was I helped them establish case law for a lot of the programs that I oppose. And, you know, getting a lawyer was a mistake. Yeah, I mean, even though I like Lance, okay, and he actually, you know, he read my book and helped me see that, you know, because I have a whole bunch of stuff about American law versus communitarian law in the book, and I wanted to kind of be sure, you know, that I wanted to buy an attorney and see what he said, and he said it was, you know, a really good read and very enlightening and let me put the quote on. So he didn't disagree with me on any level, but I told him, I said, I'm being charged with a communitarian crime here. I know this. I want to get that into court. I want it on court record that I know what's going on here. And, of course, we never did. And I ended up having to do community service. 20 hours was my punishment.
Was there fine attached to it?
$300 fine, yeah. In fact, I'm not even sure if that got paid or not. But anyway, the 20 hours of community service, I wrestled with that. You know, I'm thinking, I can't do it. I just, you know, on principle, I can't submit to this. And then on the other hand, I was like, well, hold on. And I was working on a website called KennyLake.com for the owner, and I asked the owner if she minded if I built a community toolbox on her website.
Uh-huh.
She said no. So I went ahead and posted all the plans, Local Agenda 21, Copper River, you know, Basin, all the BLM stuff, all the development plans, everything I could get my hands on the Wildlands Act, on scenic byways, grant money, all the meetings, everything. So, you know, I ended up turning it into something that I spent more than 20 hours, believe me. And so a lot of what I'm doing it now is just kind of assessing, like I've stepped back a little bit from so much research, so much, you know, I went to hundreds of meetings in Seattle, and I wrote flyers. I went to music festivals and things like that, and I was the wacko standing on the corner with a bunch of papers in my hand going, Seattle, you gotta listen to this, you know. A lot of times I was crying, you know. Nobody wants to talk to anybody who's standing there crying with a bunch of papers in their hands.
Well, and let me go ahead and do a station ID, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, community-supported radio. And before I forget, support for KHAN and TruthQuest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, Agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and my co-host tonight is Katie O'Brien, and our guest is Nikki Rapana. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I feel like I'm just monopolizing this.
I want my guests to get out as information as I try to contribute as little as possible. But you did mention a couple of things here that I'd like to follow up, because there is a tie-in with these the whole system. It's kind of like, I don't know, the best way I can describe it is like we're dealing with somebody shotgunning us with so many different issues that you don't even know which BB to go after, you know, but you just have to start picking one here or there just to get to get an idea of what is going on in our world right now, because Agenda 21 is all-encompassing. They have left nothing to, no rock unturned. Correct?
Absolutely. We're at the point now where, you know, and it's always been this way too, I thought, is that the only place we can really be effective as citizens is where we live. And the plan is everywhere. This is a complete restructuring of the system. It's a bureaucracy that's building right now as we're sitting here talking. There's a meeting somewhere right now.
Hundreds of them.
Mm-hmm. Where they're revising something, and they're rebuilding, and they're incorporating new values. And, primarily under the sustainable development umbrella, which is everywhere now. I mean, that is the key buzzword out there. Sustainable development is a communitarian program. And you don't need to understand communitarianism to understand sustainable development either, you know. I mean, each area under the plan has its own smaller structure. It's like, I don't know how to explain it verbally, but I draw a lot of charts for people too. So, in fact, my Agenda 21 page at the ACL has some of their charts, which shows the local agenda structures in Finland. I think I posted theirs on there, because in other countries of the world that have already voted socialist governments in, nobody's having to convince their people that this is they can talk about it openly in Finland. They're actually talking about it openly pretty much all over the world. The only people that don't have a clue that it's going on in the Western world is the United States. And yet, there are hundreds and hundreds of groups that I've come in contact with in my 10 years that totally understand sustainable development, that go to all these meetings, and have tried for years to work within the system because they're local business owners. They have a vested interest in their community, and they want to be good people, okay? So they're trying to get along. And that, to me, is the problem.
Well,
because
of this system? What are they saying?
Well, they're saying that, yes, there are certain issues that weren't addressed under the old system, and maybe we do need a few more limitations on the way that people can develop their land, blah, 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 you know? They think that there's a give and take, and at some level, maybe there is. But you can't start backing off. If your entire political structure is based in an ideology called property rights, and everything else it comes from that, okay? And you eliminate property rights, then there is no structure.
And there is no middle class, because then it's property rights that gives us law, and it gives us our middle class.
Well, this is where I'm so glad we got to this point, because this is the difference between American law and communitarian law. In the United States, under legitimate constitutional law, and this is state and federal constitution, there has to be damages to property. So if you're charged with a crime, a legitimate American crime, the court, the burden of proof, first of all, rests with the court. You don't have to say a word in your defense in an American courtroom. The court has to completely prove that you are guilty of damaging X. Either it's a person or it's someone's property, or whatever, okay? But it has to be something. There has to be a dead body before you can be charged with murder. Under communitarian law, there is no damages. There's a potential for a vague damage, maybe. And these are behavior modification crimes, like even a DUI. You're not being charged because you wrecked your car and killed somebody with the car. You're being charged with the potential for wrecking your car and killing somebody with your car. There's no actual damages. And even in our civil court system, try and file a lawsuit in a civil court in the United States and not put a damages claim. Because what the court is supposed to rule on is, were there damages? That's why people say emotional damage, you know. I mean, I had 9 clients that I was helping in Seattle that were in the Dawson lawsuit. And I didn't want to charge any money. I was so naive. I didn't know anything about the court system at all. And when the lawyers were like, well, we're going to charge $1 million, I'm like, no, we're going to charge zero, you know, because it's not about the money. And she's like, well, then you don't have a case. And then you have to prove the damages. So we were supposed to have to prove somehow that these police actions of taking hostages and shaking people down and all the stuff and searching their rooms and invading their private space damaged them emotionally. We were supposed to bring in records of them going to shrinks and how they suddenly couldn't work because they were so distressed over the raid. And I'm like, wait a minute, how they violated the law. Why can't we just say that and have that be it? No, that wasn't it. We had to prove that it somehow damaged the people that it happened to. So it helped me eventually to understand communitarian law, because that's the difference right there, is that in communitarian law, there's no damages. You know, and then they do it with regulations. They're actually not even called laws a lot. They're called regulations. Have you ever heard of an entry order?
No, I don't know.
No, me neither. Well, in Seattle, it's an entry order is another name or a warrant.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. But it's a different kind, you see. Because if you're getting a warrant, then you have to go to an authority of law who's authorized to sign the warrant, which is not a municipal court judge. And a lot of the judges that we were dealing with in Seattle were municipal judges. The King County Superior Court judges, you know, they were still kind of following the Constitution. But it's the municipal level. Actually, municipal is, you know, most of the stuff. That's what I mean. If you wanted to be proactive right now in retaining American freedom, the place to do it is start with the mayor of wherever you live. Go to the council meetings, get their agenda, ask for a copy of the plan, and they'll call you a conspiracy theorist and try
ask
to run
for a copy
you
of what plan?
Well, you have to find the names of them, because they don't have to produce anything unless you name it. But whatever visioning plan that they have, it's under community and economic development, regional plan might mm-hmm. be called, neighborhood plan, community development plan.
Okay.
And
why do we want to
call regional planning?
Okay, there we go. Yeah, that's it. That's the plan.
Okay, so what are we looking for in these plans?
Well, starting the mission statement will tell you right up front what the mission and the goal is of the plan, and it will be to rebuild a safer community. Promote sustainable and, you know, responsible development, responsible citizenship. It's new, you know, it's all about change. You know, like Barack Obama is just the mouthpiece for the communitarian network up there right now, you know, seeing how many people will actually go along with this ridiculous idea. And there's lots, huh, you know?
A lot. It can be made to sound like it's the panacea of an answer to all the corruption that's going on in the world and that sort of
mm-hmm.
thing.
Yeah. It's utopian.
Mm-hmm.
It's based in utopian, you know, ideology. People love the idea of utopia. You know, they asked me a lot in Seattle if I didn't want to live in a better neighborhood, why I was fighting them, because all they were trying to do is make my neighborhood nicer.
And some of the aspects that people need to be kind of aware of, too, is this problem-reaction-solution. So, in other words, a problem kind of appears on the horizon, and somebody comes up with a method to solve it. In other words, say, okay, so a gang moves in, and all of a sudden you've got all this crime, and all of a sudden, you know, we need to do something about this crime. And so now we've got, we're losing rights along the way so that we can solve this crime.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's always interesting to follow the in the areas where the crime is the most. You know, like if you look at L.A. and Watts riots and stuff, and that whole area down there, it's always about the land. You know, if somebody wants the land that you're on, and pretty much right now they want all the land. I mean, it's not, it used to be sort of specific, but now it doesn't matter where you live. There's an easement or a conservation, right? You know what they're doing right now?
What?
In Alaska, they've they're giving the Atna Indian tribe a lot of land. In fact, right now you can barely get on any of the land around here. There's no trespassing signs everywhere. So I just read in the Copper River Record that the Division of Natural Resources is trying to find people in the area that know the trails, because if we don't identify the trails by November 1st, there will be no access to state land through these Indian lands that hasn't been pre-designated.
And why do you think they're doing that?
Because they're locking up the land.
Okay, and what do the Native Americans think about it?
They think it's great.
Do they?
Yeah. They're all communitarian. The tribes were one of the first places they went with all their grant money. The people out here, they're not subsistence, you know, they're not. They live on grants. Their food stamp grant programs, everything, it's all HUD housing. The villages are HUD housing. So, you know, the whole idea that the Indians being this culture, this subsistence culture, you know, it's a lie. I mean, I'm not trying to degrade anyone here, you know, but it's a lie. And Regional Housing Authority, right up around the road in Copper Center, the Native Association runs it. They're also right now they have mental health nurses who are helping people with identify alcohol problems. You know, they're starting to, get into, they want everybody to report domestic violence. It's Domestic Violence Month or whatever, you know, and all the signs everywhere say, you know, report domestic abuse wherever you see it. That makes you a good citizen.
So anybody that comes in and identifies the fact that people are being bought off with grant money, and this is done on every level I can think of, mm-hmm. and they think that they're being... And a lot of it is. It's a lot of good works are happening from this. But the problem is they're giving up their sovereignty. They're giving up their right to say no. They're giving up their right to private property and freedom of movement. Is that what you're saying here? I mean, if they're closing off the land for accessibility, then where do they go?
Well, they want to make sure there's nowhere to go. They want to make sure that if you fish, you have to get their permission. If you hunt, you have to get their permission. If you own animals, National Animal Identification System, you know. In Seattle, they're introducing a new law that you have to be certified to own pets in the city. You have to be properly trained to do anything anymore. And you have to get permission and you have to pay. So anyone who wants to live free you're in the wrong country. You know, and then the problem is it's a global thing. And the thing with the New World Order term, you know, is such a flag. It's like, oh, and people roll your eyes, the New World Order, you know. But I don't like that term so much because I don't think it explains the bureaucratic structure. We already live in the New World Order. You can't drive, you can't purchase, you can't go anywhere, you know, change a job. Try and apply for an apartment, you got to pay $25, you have to do a background check, criminal checks, you know. I mean, you have to practically give DNA. And in some places, they've set up councils, community councils, that pre-approve the tenants moving into the neighborhood. And they practice that in HUD under Weed and Seed.
Well, they've been doing that in New York apartment buildings for quite a while, have they not?
You know, I don't know. I know that it's hard to get an apartment in New York, and people will probably do anything, pay anything. You know, there's and if they have you over a barrel, they have you over a barrel. You know, in order for you to go get a job, you know, you have to be willing to give up bodily fluids or hair or blood, you know. and we've been so, and it has been incremental, like the frog in the pot, you know, to where now you know, you start looking at all of the things that I identify as communitarian, and it's just everything. My driver's license is communitarian. You know, the registration of my car now is tied into it, you know. And I wouldn't have thought that except for the communitarian network in Amitai Etzioni came to Alaska, graded Department of Motor Vehicles, and flunked them, gave them an F, and said that their policies and procedures weren't strict enough for driver's license applicants. I've had a driver's license in Alaska for 30 years. I go down to get my new one because I had a DUI in Wyoming in 2004, and suddenly I couldn't get my license because I had to prove who I was. And they wanted me to get a new birth certificate. I was born in Wisconsin, and my birth certificate in Wisconsin was with the Bureau of Vital Statistics. Suddenly I have to reapply for a new birth certificate from the Department of Health and Human Services. And that's where the database started.
Yeah, and I do believe that's part of tracking.
Yes.
Well, then, they've got ways now that, I mean, our credit cards and everything can actually be read from somebody standing off 5 or 10 feet, you know, if we don't have them protected in some way.
Yeah. It's a high-tech world, too. I mean, you got all the other under stuff. You know, the actual paperwork, drudgery, the stuff that I deal with, okay? And then you have the technical people that understand that whole other end of it. That's not me. But it absolutely ties into, you know, the information in the cards. I wrote Washington State Department of Motor Vehicles when I was there, and I thought it was the barcode that they started putting on the back of the license.
Uh-huh.
Also, they used your social security number there. And they told me that in the barcode was the same information that was on the front of the license, nothing more. You know, than your vital statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, okay, well, then I'll get one. You know? But what I didn't understand is they had this thing called digital retinal technology, facial recognition. And they were scanning all the new pictures, have that technology in it. And that's their database, not the barcode on the back. But it was what was inside the pictures and the eyes, and so that they can find you in a crowd, too. And according to some people, when you approach the border, there's scanners on the road, so that by the time you get to the border guard thing up here on the border, they already know who you are, and they've already seen your file. And I spent years trying to get access to that file, because under American Privacy Act 1974, I have a right to see any file kept on me. And, you know, it's very detailed what information they can have, how long they can have it. They can't store it. They can't share it without the director actually writing you for permission to share it. And now it's all about interagency partnerships. And if you notice in all of the big things that happened, Katrina, 9/11, the WTO riots in Seattle, 99, the main thing they said was we didn't have enough data to predict the problem.
Yeah, right.
And Local Agenda 21 has a whole section on the importance of data. And it's all stored in the GIS. The Geographical Information System is the big grid. And, we all have to be assigned a physical address. Also, no P.O. boxes, you know. You have to have so that they know where you're supposed to be. And then I think eventually we'll all be chipped or something. I'm not quite sure how they're going to do that, but lots of ways. In the next emergency, you know, we'll have to go to our community center and we'll get assigned our jobs to help the community and assigned our living quarters. And then when we're supposed to be at home, I think they're going to have a way to know when you're there.
So a lot of these science fiction movies are blueprints for what they have up their sleeve then.
Yeah, I think they make those movies so that when you start telling somebody the actual program, the first thing that that person says is, I saw that movie.
Oh, I think that's a conditioning, definitely. It's kind of a way of acquiescing because I was listening to a speech by Aldous Huxley just recently, and part of his speech, he was talking about the fact that we need to, I mean, not everybody's going to go along, so they have to figure out a way for us to acquiesce. And so by conditioning with various things in our movies, our books, our television, in literature, you name it, they're building this up so that we acquiesce to whatever changes that they want to do before us. And when they're talking about change, they're not talking about good change necessarily, unless, you know, you really want to live in a communal society and have your every move watched and followed.
Well, and the problem is, whether you want to live in a communal society or not, if you don't fit into the communal society, that's the thing. You know, there's only so many places in this plan. They kind of remind me of the Jehovah's Witnesses and the 144,000 thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's a limit. They think that the world can only sustain X amount of people. So therefore, you know, right now I think everybody's scrambling to be in that X, you know?
I think everybody thinks they're going to be in that X. That's what's so interesting, because they're starting to marginalize certain aspects of the society, and they will keep marginalizing as they keep splitting it off, separating them out, compartmentalizing them, and if they disappear or you no longer see them anymore, you know, you're just thinking, oh, good, I'm one of the lucky ones.
Well, it's that problem reaction solution thing. You know, one of the early laws that the Hitler administration passed was clean up the streets. And after, huge depression had hit and 5 million unemployed or whatever, you know, you had a lot of people in the streets. And then they sent in their brown shirts, you know, and this is all historical fact, that they had their own thugs that went in and caused some problems. And then the solution to that thug problem, that criminal element, was to clean up the streets. And, they started euthanizing the mental patients first. And so a lot of doctors got euthanized with them because they were kind of upset about it and tried to stop it. And so I see that now, that, you know, people like me, and I've always kind of been the, I was the head of the student rights committee in high school and stuff, you know.
You're so I've on been list.
and I got to say, you know, that a lot of Americans, you know, they don't want to live like I do. They didn't want to make the choices that I made. But I never used to get the flack for the choices. You should just be, well, it's your life, Nikki, you know. If you want to go off to Alaska, go ahead. You know, nobody tried to stop me or anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's, you know, apparent within, you know, because I'm 52, my ex-husband and my sister and a lot of my friends, you know, they're all middle-class people now. You know, they have automatic garage door openers, and they have new trucks, and they got snow machines, and they got all the toys, and, you know, they got it. They got their investments, you know. They don't know what they're in, but they got them. And, it was all about the money and being, you know, comfortable and successful in your middle age. And the thing that is hardest for me is to see in the plans that they don't get to keep any of that.
Well, that's why what you call an orchestrated collapsed economic system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that didn't happen by accident. I mean, this is what's so interesting. I mean, if you start looking in their own documents, they will tell you exactly what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a matter of finding the right document and finding the right person who's talking about how they do this sort of thing, or looking at historical information on what happened elsewhere, because the same people that were behind the German orchestration are also very much involved with what's going on here.
That's why you don't often hear about the New Age aspects of the Nazi socialists, you know. Because you can find the same thing in a lot of the programs today. You know, that it's mysticism to them. It's the Tree of Life. It's the Kabbalah.
Uh-huh. You're kind of being muffled. It's hard to hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know what? I hope my phone isn't fading out.
It sounds like it.
But how much longer do we have?
We've got about a half hour.
Oh, gosh, Melody, I'm sorry. I'm on one of those cheap phones that you buy at garage sales. I cut corners where I can, you know, which is kind of what I've done with my lifestyle. You know, when I saw that everything I owned was on the table and gone as far as those people were concerned, you know, I used to be a homeowner, and I was sort of a middle-class person. And when my... Oh, you're losing me now?
Yeah. You were coming in real good there for a second.
Yeah, I thought so, too. Oh, what's going on? Interference. But anyway, I just decided to try and let go of the things that they were saying that I was going to have to let go of anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And learning to live like right now, I'm very environmentally friendly, low-impact dwellings and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm here to tell you, it's really hard. It's not glamorous. There's nothing lovely about it. It's not gonna work. People aren't gonna do this. Not after living with indoor plumbing and, you know, automatic heat. They're not. I mean, wood. Katie said she heats with wood. She knows, you know, it's a mess. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. But, I mean, when you read some of the documents or listen to some of their speeches, like, you know, they want to bring us, instead of bringing the third world up to our level, they want to bring us down to the third world level. And unfortunately, instead of giving us some of the technology that we know is out there, they're acting as though it doesn't exist. Or we're getting some really... forms of it that have a long ways to go in being developed.
Well, I think a lot of it is being blocked.
Right. I mean, because some of those that, you know...
The air car, things like that.
Mm-hmm. When you go to try to find out about some of these alternative things, then you start seeing, well, no, they're not really there or whatever, but you are aware that there is that technology out there. They'll tell you, oh, we're 40 years advanced from what, you know, we are seeing, but you know, in the meantime, we have to kind of live with what we've got. So yeah, now you're really faded out now.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah. No, that's great.
I just moved. I'm on my head. What I'm finding is that the...
That technology.
Yeah. I'm Alaskan, so we're like 20 years behind of everything. What all indigenous people knew how to do is provide for themselves. They built their own houses, and they still do in many parts of the world. We're taught to believe that these people are just living a terrible life. But they aren't dependent. I mean, if the city water goes off in Anchorage, nobody has water. If the power goes out, you don't have any power, you know? So by providing for yourself, then you're also... a certain amount of independence goes along with that. So being able to make your own things, which to our founders was real important, to be able to make and produce their own goods. They didn't want to buy from the empire anymore or have to buy, you know. They want to make their own candles and stuff. Well, now all of that information, who do you know who's how to do anything? We don't know how to do anything. I've been practicing for 10 years, and I can't believe what I don't know. So I still, you know, I'm practicing with all of the... Oh, hello?
Yeah, you're there.
Okay. I'm practicing with the stores still available, the lights are still on, you know, the well still works, everything's going on, and I'm still having it's a really difficult journey. I can't imagine doing this without all of those things there. And what I see with them doing, I see them, a complete economic collapse is not out of the question anymore, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, when they shipped all the jobs out of the country, it pretty well assures the fact that we'll be struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to lose our homes, where are we going to live?
Right.
So we will be forced to do what they socially engineer us to do.
Right. Then they build the safe and affordable housing and guarantee it to you. So that's why Gerties are such a great alternative. which are yurts, or thatched huts, or anything round.
So you can kind of put whatever. What do you do to insulate your?
I'm using Radiant Guard and wool.
Because when I looked at the picture, it looked like it was kind of different things that you utilize to make the outside.
Yep, outside and inside. I recycle materials. I use old cloth. I just put a whole bunch of wallpaper on that I got for 75 cents a roll, and this stuff works great. And it's the good thing is that it's, you know, it didn't cost me anything. If it gets wrecked, I'll just pull it off and put something else up. It's an experimental thing. I've been trying to, you know, learn how to just make my own house out of, you know, sticks and the way that, you know, the Mongolians did it for 3,000 years. It worked for them. Finding the materials that are adaptable to Alaska climate, wet, snow, wind, you know, it's been a bit of a challenge.
Is it going to fit into the international building code, though?
Well, actually, it's very eco-friendly.
Does that fit the codes?
Well, actually, no. In order for you to... People have been writing me for years now and saying, I wish I could do that here, but they won't let me. You know, no, it doesn't fit into any international building codes. So as an alternative to their program, it's not going to work unless we win. And the only reason I can do it here is because there's no government, no local government where I live.
So are you in a pretty small area then?
No, I'm in a huge area.
But no local government?
No, no local government, no borough, no city. No municipality, and no, we have boroughs up here, but it would be county out there.
So how many people live in the area?
Nobody knows for sure.
It's really loose.
Well, they try. Last census, I think they said 400. 50% unemployment.
But do they need to be employed?
Oh, obviously not. If they're, I mean, the thing about it is they don't want anybody out here. We're a designated scenic byway. We just aren't one yet because the locals won't let it happen. But they're still trying. They just, the way that they get their, the sustainable developers get their foothold through the local people. They come in, they sell the program to, you know, municipal government. They look for the greedy people, and they're always there, you know, who say, sure, I'll go along with this, and, you know, I'll get rich along the way. And they do. They get rich. They sell out their neighbors. And so a big problem with communitarianism is that it's not some, you know, global government over at The Hague. I mean, even though ultimately that is their court, the reality is the communitarians are living right next door to you. They're on Neighborhood Watch. They're on that new Sustainable Development Committee. And they totally believe in the program because the program is going to benefit them. So actually, the way to survive right now is to join the communitarians. And, you know, don't listen to me. Because,
yeah, but you
know,
can't be a troublemaker either. So you can't.
Well, no.
Okay.
So it's not a very hopeful message, is it? I'm so sorry.
So what is it? Tell us a little bit more about the scenic byway thing, and what do you know about heritage areas?
Well, I know that those are part of the global plan for massive land grabs is that program, okay? The Wrangell St. Elias Park is 22 million acres. And there's areas of those mountains where you can't get. You try to get back up in there, and they'll stop you. So, and the locals said that a few years ago there was a lot of air traffic up the Copper River and Tonsina into the Wrangell, so they think that there's some big thing out there. I have no way of verifying that or not. But, yeah, the scenic byway plan is that once they designate you a scenic byway, well, then they can come in and regulate the land use along the highway. And it's the first stepping stone to creating an area that, like out here, they want it to be wilderness. They tell the tourists that drive down in front of our house, they go, wow, there's people here. We were told there was nobody here. And I go, well, that's because they don't want us to be here. And eventually we will be gone. You know, junk storage is one of their favorites. You know, most rural people save things because they might need parts off their vehicles, you know. So they go around and they say, you have to have a fence up that has to be so high, or you have to get rid of all your cars, or you have to register all your vehicles that are on your property. You know, it's just little nitpicky ways of shutting people down. Junkyards are a thing of the past. How many junkyards do you pass nowadays, you know? You used to go into the railroad section of town and see a bunch of them. They're gone. So they're taking all our, you know, like all the new cars that got the GPS tracking systems in them, and all the you know, where you got to get your car tested for emissions and things like that. They're taking away any of the ways that people used to provide for themselves or rebuild themselves, so that when you need something, you have to go to the new system to get that vehicle, or, you know, that plow or whatever.
So you're to have to be totally dependent, and you're totally regulated.
Yes, totally regulated. You have to regulate. You have to, you know, register all yourself, your family, with them, and be willing. It's a willingness that they want. They see in their whole philosophy. Their definition of freedom comes from a man named George Hegel. And to Hegel, freedom is achieved when everyone willingly becomes a slave to the state, because the state is basically God.
And that's where you get the Hegelian dialectic.
Yes. Yes. And the Hegelian dialectic is just the tool to help humanity, push humanity in their social evolution, which these guys made up. There's no valid scientific evidence that societies evolve, okay, but that's their theory. It's all based on that, and that's why I call part two of my thesis is the historical evolution of communitarian thinking, because it's a sneer at them, you know.
Mm-hmm. What is your website, and what was the book that you wrote?
My website is nord.tw.net. It's my daughter's space. At TW, it's called, that's short for the Web Union, so it's nord.tw.net, and it's called the Anti-Communitarian League, but there's some other, all the other links to other projects we work on are on there. My blog is on there. My blog is called Living Outside the Dialectic, which is another sneer at them. I don't really live outside the dialectic, but I try. And the book is called 2020, Our Common Destiny, and that's really my daughter's book. She wanted me to condense the ACL into a small 120-page book, and we wrote it over a period of years. We almost killed each other several times because my first draft was 700 pages. She threw the whole thing out, too. It's no, Mom, no, you know. It's got to be simple. So it's actually, we're in our eighth printing, because we modify it every time we go to print. And, you know, it's got really good reception. We just haven't promoted it, and we haven't put it out there. But it's just a small, concise overview, and it's actually biographical. What she had me do was write my story,
uh-huh.
You know, and how I found it and what I know. And it's filled with quotes and references to their plans. I mean, it's nonfiction. Everything in it is true, and everything in it is, you know, totally verified. Now you can find it all online. When I first started doing my work, I had to go to the agencies themselves, and I had over 25 binders full of government documents.
Wow.
And I carried them around with me like a dummy. I took them to the offices, and I sent my compass binder to the New York Times, 500 pages, you know. I sent it to the ACLU back when I still thought they were supposed to be working for us. you know, I sent them to everyone. I wanted people to, I thought that people would read their documents and understand it better than me trying to explain it to them, but that's not the case. Nobody wants to read 500 pages of compass documents.
So what are compass documents?
It's community mapping, planning, analysis for safety strategies.
So this is what they're trying to do to us then.
Yes. Community mapping is a key part of Local Agenda 21, and that's the mapping database. They have to find out all the resources in the community, and the people in the community are considered, we're just resources. We're customers, kind of. So that mapping database is where what really got me involved. And I explained it in the book because I found out that they had my file. And I wanted to see it, and I wanted to know where it went and what they were using it for, and that made me a conspiracy theorist to them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wore the label proudly. I said, yes, okay, fine. You can call me whatever you want, but I still need to see this, and I still need to see this, you know. So I was extremely persistent. I wasn't rude. I don't recommend rude, you know. It doesn't catch a lot more flies with honey. I was friends with all the secretaries and receptionists in every department. You know, a lot of them I knew by name because I saw them regularly, because I had to file a lot of public disclosure requests before I actually started getting things from them. Some states have laws. The FOIA is, you know, still a good one. Of course, there's a lot of documents now you can't see, you know, under the Patriot Act and some of these other new measures are, you know, they're passing more. They don't want you to know. They won't want you to be able to find out, but you still can. And
I find it so interesting because a lot of them, before they ever got started, had to sell the idea. So they did a lot of books and put out documents of what they projected to be taking place when they met their, you know, their utopia of whatever it is. Correct?
Right.
Yeah, and so now they're trying, when you confront them about them implementing the process, now they act like they, you know, they don't. It doesn't exist, and everybody's so compartmentalized, a lot of them don't get the big picture.
No, they don't know who they're working for. I was at a speak out in Kitsap County where they had a lot of, some of the most beautiful maps I've ever seen were at that one. And one of the gals that was working there, I went outside to smoke a cigarette because I'm one of those bad people that still smokes. And she came out, and she wasn't smoking, but, you know, she started chatting with me. I can't remember why, but I asked her how she felt working for the United Nations. And she said, I don't work for the United Nations. I said, yes, you do. She said, no, I don't. And I go, yes, you do. And that's amazing to me that you don't know that. You don't even know who wrote the blueprint for those maps you got in there and all the stuff that's in your paperwork and your documents. And she was young. I upset her, you know. And I meant to, I got to say. I thought she needed to really, you know, go back to your computer and go look some of this stuff up. So, you know, the people in Seattle, when I got, you know, I put some pressure on a couple of them, and they all quit and disappeared, by the way. Okay, so if you get somebody in within one of these agencies that actually starts telling you stuff, I guarantee you they ain't going to be there very long, you know, because I was frustrating them with my questions, and they were telling me things that they never should have told me, you know. And, like, when I was trying to find the justification for this stupid police raid for bugs and rats, one of the women at the Department of Neighborhoods, who was the head of this committee that I had been going to several meetings, I'm trying to get an interview with her, and I'm trying to get her to explain it to me. She told me that sometimes sacrifices have to be made for the common good. And that's straight out of Marxism. You know, I was, like, completely familiar with that term. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, what sacrifices? You know, what about you? Why don't we go to your house and do this stuff, you know? Because it's never them, you see. It's always that other scumbag slumlord, and they're, you know, it's like my dad. When my dad was in Vietnam, he didn't call them Vietnamese, he called them gooks. Why? Because it dehumanizes them. If you can call people names and throw labels on them, like transients with a significant negative impact, then they're no longer human, and you don't care what happens to them. It's like you said, they go for the marginalized groups, or they marginalize you, especially if you got prime real estate that they want.
Right.
Yeah. And then you're the lone, you know, rancher or, you know, rural farmer standing up at the meeting, and the only thing
in a compound.
Yeah. And you say things like, I think you all are communists. You know, I heard that a few times. And then the people in the committee roll their eyes and go, oh, one of those, you know, one of those patriot wackos, you know. And they're really awful. And I would watch them. I'd watch the way they talk to my elders. I come from a very strong line of, you respect your elders, or we're going to knock you out, you know. That's my dad's way of looking at things, you know. So I was shocked, the way that they were talking to these people. And pretty much, you know, it shuts you down. If you're in a room full of people and you're the only person standing up and saying, this doesn't seem right to me, or I don't understand, and everybody in the room rolls their eyes and laughs at you, you know, it's a very rare person that'll stand there and go, well, you people are all a bunch of idiots, you know? No, you go, okay. And usually there's a wife or a husband going, sit down. What are you doing? You're embarrassing me, you know? So it's been very effective.
Well, another one that I think is kind of an interesting way of controlling them is they'll always be given to the person that, you know, there's a legal reason why you can't say anything, or you know, you need to talk to a lawyer first before you, talk to them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh, they used to tell me in the meetings all the time that they'd see me after the meeting and explain it to me later.
And did they?
No, they ran. I chased a couple of them. I'm like, hey! I'm running down the hall, you know, and then my family's like, what are you doing? You're losing your mind. I'm like, well, why aren't you? This is what I started telling people. People go, Nikki, you're very upset over this. You need to calm down. I'm going, no, you need to get upset. So we didn't agree, you know, and obviously, you know, my reputation within my, you know, 30-year network of friendships, you know, it pretty much ended very quickly. And even, you know, even now, as they're all facing financial ruin, and everyone in this country knows it, nobody's looking at what's going on going, hey, it's going to be good.
I mean, we promote corrupt criminals. It just floors me. I mean, it just amazes me. They're going to be running the world banking system, and they should be, you know, behind bars. But no, you got to do huge crimes. If you do, you know, like you said, you don't paint your fence or you do something else, they'll fine you to death over it. But, you know, if you go out there and take everybody's pension and create this unbelievable derivative thing that nobody could ever, you know, define what a derivative was.
And then we actually bail them out and let them be re-in charge.
Right. That's what I'm saying. We promote them.
Yeah, and then AIG, wasn't that interesting to find out who they were?
I worked for AIG at one time.
Oh, did you really?
It's one of those
where they were?
Actually, I suspected, and I got out, before 2000, and that was before the, you know, things started collapsing. And something was telling me something, but you know, my heart wasn't into some of that either. So,
well, I used to define myself as a libertarian socialist green. And, you know, that to me today is just so ridiculous. I can't believe I used to say that. But I was trying to find my belief system within the system, you know. And that's, you know, that's a big part of the brainwashing, is that, you know, following your instincts and your gut and your heart telling you that something's wrong when it looks so nice and everybody else seems to think it's a good idea. What's wrong with you, you know? So I ended up internalizing a lot of my objections, and I would sit at night and go, why am I so opposed to this? You know, everybody else seems to think it's okay, you know. And of course now I'm validated 10 years later, but I also knew that when I was validated would mean that it was so bad that it was almost too late to do anything about it. Even though there are huge groups growing around the world, England, very smart people over there studying Stop Common Purpose. And then in Canada, you know, our contributor to 2020 with a Canadian perspective is a man named Paul Barnes. He's running as an independent. There's another candidate in Montana named Dick Mata. You know, there are people that are actually still going into the electoral system and attempting to thwart it, you know, at the grassroots level. So,
That's about the only, that's the most logical way to address it, is to get active in your community and start pointing things out, saying, you know, have you noticed this? You know, does that seem strange to you? Or running for office, like you're saying?
Yeah, then it gives you an opportunity to present the issues that are never addressed by any of the candidates, you know, normally, okay? Not even Ron Paul would tackle communitarianism or mention Amitai Etzioni or anything, you know? I mean, there's certain people that are untouchables. And, you know, according to the U.S. military, the Mossad has free rein in the United States, so you don't get to complain. You don't get to do anything that steps on their toes. And that's the problem with Etzioni, is he's high-ranking Israeli military, so, you know, I bring up his name and they tell me to be quiet and be afraid because of the powers, you know, that could arise against me. And so there's a lot of, you know, if you don't have natural fear, they'll try and put it into you. You know, it's like sometimes I think, like where I'm at now, that I kind of want to start going to the meetings. I want to go to the local development meetings and just with everything I know and just listen and see where they're at, because they are advancing. And they talk about things more openly. In Iowa, they call it Local Agenda 21.
Really?
Seattle now is saying that they support all the goals and objectives of Local 21, Local Agenda 21. You know, so there's not, it's not as hidden. So that means that I think that they think they're untouchable now. I think that they marginalize people like me, you know, just a regular person that comes along and starts asking all the wrong questions. And then I just happen to have a journalism background that I went after the information and the documents. But very few people have that capacity. So when you do go, you know, you got to find somebody that can read their plans.
Or interpret their plans.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of times they put down plans and they don't go into their application. You know, it'll look real good in writing, but the application is not good for humans.
Right. Well, and you'll read, like, the first 12 objectives, you'll go, okay, I agree with that. That looks good. Yeah, sure, okay. You know, and then you get to number 13, and it says, and everybody has to turn over all their personal information to the local database. So, yeah, they bury them. And they make it seem like, you know, it's like nobody wants to live in a dirty, filthy community. You're not going to say that anyway, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's their either-or pose. Don't you want to live in a nice community? If you say no, then who are you? What kind of a person says that? And they're always helping. You know, they care. They'll tell you, we've been working on this for a really long time. Where were you when we spent all the time working out all these details, you know? So, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to argue with them.
Well, it's
kind of
like when you get these guys that call you up for these polls, and they're always questions phrased around the answer they want. And that's what happens in these meetings. And so they'll talk about consensus, 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 and what it really is they're eliminating everything, like you said earlier, that doesn't fit their... you know, what they desire to be the consensus.
Yeah, and they do things like they write policies. There was a group in Seattle called the Citizens Council. So I went to that meeting because I'm a citizen, and I asked all the wrong questions, and they wrote a new policy that said citizens have to be invited. And so I wrote them up and said, well, I'm invited, right? And, you know, they started passing the buck. But, yeah, they're, you know, if, and then I probably could have been a lot more effective if I wouldn't have been so emotionally upset. You know, but seeing that they brought, you know, SWAT cops and took people hostage in a situation that had nothing to do with the police and shouldn't have, you know.
Well, that's the spooky part about it, is they're willing to back this up with a police state.
Yes. And, you know, they're training our police in Israel.
Hmm.
With Israeli, you know, because they're the Harvard of anti-terrorism. And so they're recommending to American police that, you know, they shoot suspects in the head rather than in the chest, because if you shoot a suspect in the chest, they might have explosives that could detonate. And I'm reading through this whole thing, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, under American law, you're innocent until proven guilty. We don't have assassination squads in our police. Well, yes, we do. If you, you know, watch it in Seattle, yeah, I've seen the snipers there. So there's snipers attached to every police force now. They had a whole program called Troops More, which community-oriented policing paid the municipal and county governments that hired these new community police that had at least 2 years military, prior military training. I can't remember if it was a $2,000 or a $5,000 bonus that the actual city got that for bringing these people in. And then they had a big thing where they spread out all the leftover technology and equipment from the Cold War. Rather than letting it waste, they distributed it to community police teams across the country. That's where you've seen all the Humvees, and some places they got tanks and all kinds of stuff. And one of the last things that Sarah Palin did when she was mayor of Wasilla was drive through a new bill that got them all kinds of new technology for the police cars, which she also helped establish the police station there. There was no police station, there was no organized municipality until she got involved. So her history up here goes way back, and it's all connected to communitarian development and grants. She got a lot of grants for that little area where there was nothing and built a big, huge suburb. It's called a bedroom community, you know, to Anchorage. And you can't drive through Wasilla without seeing cops. And they come right up on your car. It's very aggressive. And the police station actually looks like a medieval castle or something. I don't know. It's a weird place. So the cops that work with the community development teams are going to go door to door doing the interviews. But they're friendly. You know, don't worry. But at that point, they're just coming by and saying hi. They want to come in and have coffee, talk to you, look around your house, and then they'll, you know, check out how you live. Is your kitchen clean? Are your kids clean? You know, are there any signs of drug use or alcohol abuse in the house? And these all go into the, the database. And then they do what's called potential for crime analysis based on all the evidence they have about you. You know, do they need to protect you from yourself?
Well, we're getting to the point here where you need to come to a close.
Can't
for the
sum
evening.
It up, huh? Leave people with something, you know.
Positive.
positive, yes. The positive news is there are a lot of Americans who are aware. And they won't know maybe the philosophy or anything else, but they will understand the laws. The most powerful and oldest groups in the country are the property rights groups, the Klamath Bucket Brigade, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, people that have been on the front lines for years. Citizen Review online up in Kitsap County has a great website of a lot of pertinent information. I learned a lot from them. So if, you know, people start looking and look for property rights, even though that's like the bad word, that's actually where you're going to find everything, because the whole plan is about stealing the land and the people and everything on it. But it always comes down to the land. So if you're in an area that has anything that's called, you know, revised land use regulations, you're under new laws, and you can actually go to your city council and your mayor's office and start asking questions. And it's better if, you know, you got a little support and there's more than one of you. But, show up. And that's what Americans don't know how to do. They think that they vote and mind the law, then they're going to be fine. And that's not true. I mean, we have to go to these meetings. We have to take over the groups somehow, you know, and these aren't elected positions. These are all self-appointed jobs. So self-appoint yourself.
Give yourself a title and step up to the
plate.
Step
up to the plate, yep. I mean, I was thinking about more positive names for the Anti-Communitarian League, which I'll never change that because it's a research institute and it'll stay what it is. But, you know, something more positive like United Commoners Association. I kind of know why I like that one, probably because, you know, it's about commoners. It's about the middle class and the poor. You know, the elites, they don't plan on suffering.
Right. Yeah. And I, what's really interesting though is a lot of them I don't know. The one thing that is still struck me odd is when you have a capital system that becomes a monopoly. I mean, that doesn't leave many players left to make a living, and unless you're doing it under their terms. So the free enterprise system kind of goes by the wayside, it appears.
Right. Somehow we've got to learn how to take our equilibrium back. Up until 1929, you know, Trotsky was talking about the power of the balance between agriculture and industry of the United States, and it was causing it to be so slow in evolving towards global communism because of the strength of that we supported ourselves as our industry left and our agricultural left. You know, now we're going to be left with rebuilding that, and you need land and resources to do that. So that's why they're locking up the land, protecting all this wilderness so that you can never go and, you know, cut down any trees or find any coal or, you know, do any of the things that you're going to need, you know, because right now I'm looking at winter and wood is a big issue for me, how I'm going to heat my house, you know. So available land to cut wood, there is none. I live right next to a 22 million acre park and I can't find nowhere to cut wood.
Right.
That's where we're at, and that's Colorado. I'm sure same thing. Montana, Wyoming, all, you know, Idaho.
Right.
The rivers, you can't use the streams anymore. They're locking it up. Anywhere that you could survive by hunting or fishing, you know, that's only sports now. You can't actually live off that, you see. So I think that, you know, locally, that's where you have the most power. It's the only place we have any power.
Right. Well, I need to say goodnight and appreciate you coming on the program, Nikki, and kind of going over some of the information that you've become familiar with, and I'd love to have you back again.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It went fast.
So, well, and we enjoyed it. So, Katie and Nikki, I want to say goodnight. And
thank you. It was very enjoyable.
Thank you, too, Katie. Nice meeting you. Nice meeting you both.
Okay. Well, thank you. Good night.
Good night.